The Meaning of Mistletoe, from The Secret Language of Plants, by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 2. The Childhood. The world kept looking for Harry. Harry, unknowing and unconcerned by this, went on living and learning. Harry knew all the letters by now, even if he often forgot about L's. He could write his own name, as well as Remus's and Severus's, but he usually forgot about the second E in Severus. He knew the names of all the plants in his garden. Every time Snape came, he made him quiz him and proudly showed him how well he remembered. Harry was perfectly happy, as only children can be. 4. After the Sleeping Beauty scare, Remus made sure always to watch films and read books before passing them to Harry so he would never have to go through another night of terror. Most were harmless, but he took Cinderella away because he rightly guessed that Harry would be too upset by the mistreatment from the family. The Sword and the Stone he banned for himself because the last thing he needed was Harry getting more encouragement to make the crockery fly and dance around the house. He wasn't doing much yet, but the plastic set he had gotten on Christmas had seen 50 good hours of flying from whenever Harry saw that thrice-cursed musical number, and lately the actual crockery was starting to hum or jump with the song. So, no more funny domestic magic. You wouldn't think this would be such a common example that he would have to worry about it. Dangerous depictions of magic use in children's movies. But then he watched Fantasia, which didn't even have a plot, and yet there was a whole scene about magical accidents that of course Harry would instantly recreate given half the chance. Robin Hood, however, was safe. There were songs and talking animals, and later Harry could pretend he was shooting arrows in the garden and overthrowing tyrants with no damage to the furniture whatsoever. That November, Snape apparated in Naunton early. He waited around the park, looking at the church's stained glass windows while he cast the usual hominem revelio to ensure he wasn't being followed. He apparated to the cottage and wholeheartedly approved of Lupin's frown and discreet behavior.
"Snape, what can I do for you?"
asked Lupin with a friendly smile. The house's door firmly closed behind him, his wand at the ready.
"Gaston does look a bit like Lucius Malfoy," said Snape, and Lupin relaxed.
It was the quickest way to prove that it was really him. While it wasn't strange for him to drop by unannounced, they both tended to be extra tense around the moon. That this time he arrived well before the sunset couldn't help but raise alarms.
"Shit, I mean, sorry, you gave me a fright."
Lupin waved his wand in the air and the front garden cleared. Severus hadn't noticed before. There was not a darkening, exactly, but some sort of fog descending over them. Now it felt as if a gray layer had been peeled away.
"I won't be able to stay tonight."
"What?"
"There has been an incident. My presence is required at Hogwarts."
To his credit, Lupin didn't argue. He didn't like it, nor did Severus, but he jumped readily to finding a solution. The night came early, but the full moon wouldn't appear until a couple of hours later. He could give Harry an early dinner, transform in the attic, and what? Spend the night there and leave Harry alone downstairs? That wouldn't work. They reached a solution. They would never have come to it by themselves, but they had somehow grown used to thinking together. Severus went back to Hogwarts via two apparitions and flewing in from a pub in Oxford to his office. Now that the situation with the lost child secretly living in the woods with a werewolf had been satisfactorily solved, he could attend to the real mess. Helga's hell, why was his life like this? He rested his head for a few seconds, his fingers pressing against the bridge of his nose.
"Severus?"
"Yes, Minerva."
He kept his eyes closed and the fingers pressing. It was perhaps rude not to make eye contact, but Minerva would understand.
"How's the potion going?"
"About..."
He opened his eyes then and glanced at the glittering purple clock floating above a cauldron.
15 minutes, and I can add the black locust."
Minerva's hair had escaped from her usual tight and neat bun. There was a stain of something that could be vomit on her left sleeve. Severus wanted to ask, but he feared the answer. They waited in silence until the purple clock started to vibrate and emit a clinking sound. Severus vanished it with a wave of his wand. He had already measured the essence of black locust earlier, but he did so again. When you're working with poisons, you should measure them every time you give them your back. He added 7 drops to the mixture, and the potion turned black, and then chrome yellow. Severus stirred it with an iron ladle. This was important, too. Any other material in the result would be corrupted.
"How are the children?" he said at last. We had to move them from the infirmary, Minerva said, with her eyes fixed on the cauldron and on Severus's hands. Many more children required medical care than Poppy had beds to hold them. One of the Hufflepuff prefects needed attention for various bites and a sprained ankle. There was perhaps a hint of reproach in Minerva's words. We had to lock them in a classroom, she went on. But a few of them escaped whilst we were moving them there, and are still roaming the castle. Everybody is looking for them. The Gryffindor prefects have corralled two in the bathrooms.
Minerva could sound as guilt-inducing as she pleased, implying that Severus had it easy absconding to the dungeons. This wouldn't have happened had they hired him as the DADA teacher. Mulciber had to run into the lake to shake them off. That gave Snape pause. Mulciber, like his father, was a big wizard, and Severus knew he had mastered quite a lot of hexes and curses. He should have been able to defend himself from a bunch of third years, no matter how aggressive they had turned. He brought the distiller to the table. "It may be best if we vaporize it," he said. Remus opened his eyes to a world of silver and shadows, black and white with the barest hints of yellow and blue. He stretched slowly, his front and back legs. If he was careful, the transformation into wolf wouldn't hurt as much as the transformation back. He looked at the door. He remembered. The wolf couldn't remember. The wolf only knew rage and pain. The wolf would have lashed at the door, trying to escape, and he would have gotten a dose of aconite grown in their garden that would have put him to sleep before he took five more steps. Severus was reasonably sure the dose would not kill him, but he hadn't made any promises. Aconite was very toxic, and the one in the garden hadn't been tested. If its intensity was higher than usual, Remus hadn't minded. He would die before getting to Harry. He didn't want to die, but he would do it gladly if the alternative was hurting Harry in any way. And he trusted that Severus would still look after him. That was the most important thing, really. But that wouldn't be the case tonight, because Remus remembered. He waited 15 minutes, nonetheless. Remus had never been able to afford Wolfsbane, but some months he managed to get enough to pay for the black market version, only you never knew for sure what you were getting. They often used expired ingredients when they didn't just substitute them. Snape had been livid when he mentioned it. Remus knew that the alternative potion could lose some of its effects, could make you snap at nothing, barely control the cravings for flesh and blood. Essentially, it made the wolf more intelligent, but still unable to rein in its fury unless you were completely isolated. Remus had stopped taking it because of that. Severus had ordered him to stop taking it and promised not to do it ever again because he could die. In fact, his death was more likely than the wolf actually managing to hurt anyone, improved intelligence notwithstanding. A brew that wasn't perfectly balanced could already be lethal. If it didn't use the right ingredients, it was a guaranteed death. So Remus waited, like he always did, for the telltale signs of a bad dose. He made some mental calculations and thought about the groceries list. There's nothing like the thoughts of bread and milk and beans to check if you're about to become a bloodthirsty maniac. If you can still think about how much broccoli to buy, as little as possible, they were getting their vitamins from other sources, you were probably fine. He stepped outside, careful of the trap by the door. Harry had been playing kitchen and potions. He was now laying on the floor on his stomach, reading by himself one of the picture books he had gotten that summer for his birthday, surrounded by the toys that he still hadn't put away. Remus pushed and nipped lightly at Harry's bum to make him put his toys away. The kid knew he was supposed to do it. He was testing the limits of how much he could get away with the beast. And this fact squeezed hard at some nerves in Remus's chest, that Harry thought that the beast could be more lenient than the two humans. He shepherded Harry to the bathroom to brush his teeth and then to bed. Harry went through the routine pleasantly, and since he could not have a story read to him, he picked up a book with lots of big pictures to look at and asked for Remus to stay. He fell asleep in his bed, his head pillowed on Remus's side. With the potion ready, there was no way Severus could beg off the miserable task of patrolling the corridors of Hogwarts, finding the third-year students and dosing them from a safe distance with the calming potion. He entered the girls' bathroom in the second floor, where Quirinus Quirrell was trying to keep one of the stalls closed by leaning over it with his whole body. His feet were sliding over the wet, slippery floor. "She bit me!" screamed Bathsheda Babbling, professor of ancient runes. She was washing her hand in the sink. "She bit me in the hand! As I was casting a sleeping incantation!" She looked at Severus in horror. Severus noticed that she didn't have her wand with her. "Oh, dear Rowena, help me!" cried Quirrell as the door shook. The wood around the hinges was starting to splinter.
"I told her it was better to leave her alone,"
the ghost of Moaning Myrtle informed Severus.
She was quieting down here by herself. But she said no, and she stood on the toilet on the next stall and tried to hit her with a charm, and that's when she bit her. It was kind of cool.
What was it with female teenagers, alive or dead, that they felt like confiding in Severus? Why didn't this happen when he was a teenager? Severus opened the smoking vial and directed the fumes with his wands to the staff. The door stopped shaking. 5 minutes later, they exited the bathroom, levitating the unconscious body of Henrietta Wilgen. Severus saw Minerva and Pomona Sprout go running past at the far end of the corridor, chasing a boy currently wearing only his uniform shirt and one sock. He made sure to take his group through the other end of the corridor.
"So what happened the other night?" asked Lupin with a glint in his eyes. If you felt like lying to yourself and being a bit too poetical, you could describe them as golden, but really they were just light brown with a bit of green. They were not gold. They looked like a window open to the forest outside and the smell of pine and wild honey in the wind. Severus just couldn't stand inaccuracies. They both had a glass of wine, and Remus had put some cheese slices in the middle of the table for their chat.
Servetere thought that the students would benefit from some practical experience casting potangos in the defense of charms.
That sounds very reasonable. My theory can only take you so far.
Severus paused and looked at Lupin. He took a sip from his glass.
He did not throw rubber or yarn balls at them, did he? Asked Lupin, because he actually had some measure of sense.
No, he did not.
Was it hard balls? Stones?
What does it mean when a teacher throwing rocks at his students would actually be preferable?
No, Lupin, he did not throw stones at the third-year students. Because this was a practical exercise, he thought he would have them stop some hexes.
Oh, no.
Lupin got up from the chair and circled the kitchen twice with second-hand horror and embarrassment. Actually, it was something he did a lot when he felt strong emotions walking in circles.
No. What did he...
Merlin, no, don't tell me.
Ferrorum Magnum, Severus said as Lupin flailed.
You see, he thought other students would find it funny when their classmates started acting crazy.
Damn, Merlin, Morgana, and Cersei, I can't see any more.
Severus took another sip of wine. He deserved it.
Of course, these being third-year students at their first exercise, they all failed casting Potenko, and if they didn't... They soon did after being attacked by their classmates.
Soon the whole class had been affected by the curse. They didn't have any trouble overcoming Sauveterre. They went at him madly, and in some cases literally biting at his ankles and foaming from the mouth. They had broken his wand. Soon Hogwarts found itself fighting demented and highly aggressive third-year students who moved too quickly to allow for more than one attempt at a charm before they tried to bite your nose and tear your ears off. They could only be calmed down with the deep sleep potion Severus had to hurriedly brew, and even then some were stirring in their sleep.
But why didn't you cast Petrificus Totalis on them?
Oh, there was some Petrificus, but only partial. And they were so enraged they could actually shake them off.
Lupin laughed at this. Severus supposed that from his perspective it was funny. It hadn't felt funny then, when you had to face a 13-year-old hissing and roaring at you, and of course people didn't want to hurt them, so they hesitated and they got hurt instead. The number of injuries was truly embarrassing, especially when you considered that the third years were not using magic. He had to admit that the Gryffindor prefects had truly risen to the occasion, which made Lupin shine with shared house pride. They kept fighting and were unafraid to use some light curses, and so they managed to temporarily stop some of the raging students, and after the transport fiasco, they helped to corral them again. The Slytherin prefects had all locked themselves in their rooms, claimed they always did that during lunch, and that they were studying and didn't hear a thing. That despite one of the wild third years managing to enter the common room and the screams of the rest of the students who were left to fend for themselves. Severus suspected that this had to do with Mulciber's run into the lake. His Slytherins obviously weren't above sacrificing one of their own to clear the common room. Lupin laughed again loud and clear at Severus's retelling of how Hagrid had had to fish Mulciber out of the lake. And then he laughed so hard he splashed some wine when he heard of the three girls who got the drop on Quirrell and for some reason claimed his clothes as a war prize. One of them had 14 torn sleeves on her, so it obviously held some meaning.
How? Asked Lupin between shakes of laughter. How could they if it was...
Well, Bathsheba Babbling had been bitten earlier on her wand hand, so she couldn't protect him.
And you?
I had to make sure that I would get all of them with the potion, didn't I? It is such a nice feeling, talking to someone and making them laugh. Severus found he was quite enjoying himself. Next, he would tell Lupin about Minerva growling right back at the boy who had managed to make 4 sixth-year students hide in a closet. Snape started to come about twice a month and spend the whole weekend with them. Remus looked forward to it because he hadn't had time for himself in over a year. He couldn't even go get a haircut. He had had to give up on shaving and grow a beard because it was easier to keep. But whatever personal errands he had to do, they didn't take the whole weekend. Saturday evenings and Sundays were just days. Days he spent with Snape and Harry, when they took him to parks and once to the botanical garden, and Snape answered all of Harry's questions about plants, and later he also helped with dinner preparations. Harry knew the word variegated. He could differentiate lobed leaves. He was starting to remember the name of the plants in Latin. Yet he still forgot to put his toys away and consistently put his shirts inside out. Remus kept finding crayons in the most peculiar places. On this Saturday, Remus returned home from some quick trip to the shops, quick because he didn't have a curious 4-year-old with him, to find Harry standing on his kitchen stool, elbows deep in flour.
"Remus! We're making a cake!"
he screamed. That they were doing. Snape had taken his black robe off and was down to the shirt and trousers he wore underneath.
"Severus is doing the eggs. I strain the flour."
Harry kept talking exclusively in exclamations for the next 2 hours. The cottage was soon full of the sweet smell of baking, and Harry was given permission to lick the spoon and pans used. That was a spectacle all by itself, the elation he could derive from a spoon. Then Harry sat down in front of the oven, transfixed by the magic that took simple, and tasteless in many cases, ingredients, and made them into something delicious. Forget the occasional levitating object or the changing color wallpaper in his room. For Harry, magic was in baking. And that night, Snape and Remus shared a small glass of wine over conversation, as it had somehow become their routine. Nobody was surprised by the announcement that Sauveterre would not continue as DADA teacher in Hogwarts. Turning the third-year students into violent maniacs was bad enough, but when the same thing happened in February with the fourth years, it was harder to find any excuses for his behavior. Plus, there was the very real chance that if he stayed, he would be murdered by Minerva McGonagall, who would no doubt make it look like it had been Severus, because that woman didn't forgive or forget. Harry put on weight, and Remus had to restrict the amount of candy he was eating. It wasn't that much candy to begin with. Remus suspected it was his body's reaction to those 2 years when Harry wasn't being fed properly. That was all right. There were many other things to eat and smell and explore. In the summer, Severus took him to the fields around the house, and Harry picked dandelion leaves to wash and make into soup. Severus also taught him how to make his very first, very magical, potion, a simple solution to cure small cuts. Although, really, Harry was still fascinated by the magic that turned plain, tasteless flour into deliciousness. 5. Harry was turning 5, and so he would soon start going to the school. Remus had explained it was a place to go and learn things, so Harry was quite happy about it. In the week of his birthday, they caught the bus, and Remus took him to the big city. They went to the cinema and watched an animated movie called Aladdin that Harry liked very much. Remus said that Harry had to be a bit like Aladdin, and couldn't show people that he could do certain things like the genie did. Outside the house, it had to be a secret. So Harry definitely shouldn't make the carpets fly, even if he thought the other kids would enjoy it. Remus thought they were very well prepared for Harry's beginning of school. They had all the adequate Muggle papers for one Harry Fleamont, and not Potter, after that grandfather he would never get to know. They didn't want to risk his name leaking out from the Muggle world back to Wizarding Society, and if Severus had tracked down the Evans to Dursley, so could anyone else. They had the school supplies and a bright and colorful backpack with Lumiere and Cogsworth. They had a child who already knew how to read and write decently and who seemed excited at the prospect of attending school. There was, however, something they hadn't accounted for. Snape had been all for making Remus a widower, but Remus had felt a bit uncomfortable about claiming paternity, even if he did think of Harry as his own. They had decided instead that he would play the role of an uncle caring for his nephew after the tragic death of his sister and her husband. It was closer to the truth, and it left Remus free to talk to Harry about James and Lily if and when the child decided to ask. So they had a perfectly good background for both of them. A good tight story that didn't arouse any suspicions, or rather, a story that deterred people from asking questions. They both knew that questions were a danger. What neither of them had considered was that from an outside perspective, Remus came across as a young, tall, ruggedly handsome man who was selflessly taking care of a child. A bad boy turned good. What neither of them had considered was that Sirius Black, cursed be his name, was the dashing boy of their year, but Remus didn't look half bad either. Remus stood among the group of mothers and the occasional father that waited for the children, chatting happily with all of them. He had always enjoyed people's company, even if it was soon withdrawn from him. He was focused, however, on delivering his story right while looking perfectly muggle and conventional, and on listening to the multiple offers of help and advice that were coming his way. The woman who used white wine for cooking was onto something. She would pass him her recipe for chicken, so perhaps Remus could be excused for not noticing right away. The mothers thought Remus was adorable. Harry's teacher, Miss Bliss, thought he was adorable and yummy. Even Mr. Bertrand, the music teacher, looked at Remus once and spent the rest of the term questioning what he knew about his sexuality. The children left the school. Harry started to run when he saw Remus, a big excited grin on his face. Remus crouched to pick him up. His shirt sleeves were rolled up, exposing strong arms that flexed and strained against the clothes as he easily lifted Harry in the air. The sun caught on his light hair, and he smelled his wolfish smile that did things to people's bellies and the region just below. There was a unison moan behind him. Remus didn't hear it, though, because Harry was babbling in his ear about all the things he had done and seen and how he had a chair assigned, which was green, but light green, like an apple, not dark green like moss, and there were other children, and two of them cried, and during recess they could play with even more children, and. The wind was crisp and cold, but the sun was still strong enough to warm them. A jacket or a sweater was enough for a countryside walk. There were still blackberries on the bushes, and Harry was happily looking for and eating them. He also had a small wicker basket transfigured from a wicker bowl at home that one of the ladies had gifted Remus. They had put a plastic bag inside, and Harry was collecting berries to later put in a pudding. Remus was telling Snape about Harry's latest adventures in school and how he seemed the kind of kid who was actually happy to sit and do his homework. It was amazing how curious he was about everything. Sitting was perhaps an exaggeration. At best of times, Harry was a blur of movement and sound. Even when he sat quietly and unmoving, the things that surrounded him did not. But he was happy to learn, is what Remus meant. It was ridiculously domestic and peaceful, this walk in the country with the werewolf and the ex-Death Eater and the child. When they returned to the house, Harry was sent to thoroughly wash his purple hands and face. He went along, singing a song to himself.
"Oh, and I brought you this."
Remus looked up, surprised. Snape had a piece of parchment in his hands. He had very nice hands, different from Remus's own big and hairy pair, but somehow appropriate-looking for potions or cooking, narrow and long-fingered and white. Remus took the piece of parchment, that in itself was enough to tell him it came from the wizarding world, and read over it quickly. It was an advertisement from a journal, requiring all kinds of writers on scholarly topics.
"Snape, what? You will have the mornings free now. You could do it."
Remus was doubtful. Even more when Snape said he had seen Hewitt, the current idiot teaching DADA at Hogwarts, looking at the advert and penciling down the information. It seemed like they wanted proper academic writing for articles and short responses to readers' queries. Remus doubted he was the most appropriate person. Although the job seemed easy and so convenient for him, he could write from home and send the articles by owl.
"You can do it," repeated Snape.
And there was a bit of anger in his tone, and Remus wondered as to where it was directed.
"You have to. If you don't, he will get the assignments."
"Snape, he is a professor at Hogwarts. I'm sure we can't be compared." That, exactly, is what Snape thought. They couldn't be compared. The Slytherin prefects had come to him to complain just after the first month of class. Severus had to give them some bibliography and sign permissions to access the restricted section of the library so they could study for themselves. The man thought you could just stupefy both gnomes and red hats alike. Remus stared in horror. You could stupefy a gnome if for some reason you didn't feel like shaking them a bit to disorient them, although, of course, Remus was more partial to non-violent solutions like spreading a trail of cheese and breadcrumbs from the garden of the house to another field. The gnomes would be gone in a night, especially if the trail ended somewhere near a source of water in an oak or some other tree that produced nuts. More importantly, this method guaranteed that the gnomes wouldn't sneak back into the garden within the week, as they often did. For comparison, the Red Hat would punch you on the ankle, and they were strong enough to crack bone. You couldn't stupefy them. You could, but you would have to be very fast and very nimble, or you would soon find yourself on the ground with a swollen ankle and a Red Hat sitting on your chest. What you should do instead was cast a Languidus Flundus, which would make a debilitating circle around you, thus keeping your ankles intact. Spraying a mixture of sulfur and geranium robertarium leaves would keep them away, although Red Hats usually lived by themselves, whereas gnomes were gregarious creatures. Severus looked at him, perfectly impassive. Well, no, not impassive. Remus was learned enough on Snape by now to know he was secretly smiling. He actually smirked outwardly as he pushed the ad forward.
Don't let that man get this job, please.
Remus sent 1,500 words explaining how to properly deal with gnomes and not to get them confused with redcaps. He got a reply a week later, stating the frequency of the assignments and the payment he would receive. It had been mere survival instinct. The child, Harry, thought that the Disney songs were among the best in the world, which, fine, they were actually pretty good. They did lose some of their charm after having heard them well over 200 times, but they were good. Only now that he was going to school, Harry had been introduced to a series of atrocities Muggles were selling under the label Children's Music. And perhaps Lupin could take it. He claimed to be a nerd to any kind of music now, but Severus couldn't. He couldn't. Why would anyone add a banjo to a perfectly decent folk song? Why the high pitch? So Severus took Harry to Spinner's End and introduced him to proper music. He was still too young to fully appreciate Bohemian Rhapsody, but someone had at least to show him that there was a world beyond songs that listed farm animals. They spent the whole of Saturday afternoon and listened to a sample of almost half of Severus's collection until he could get a good sense of what Harry liked. He liked the most rhythmic songs of Queen, good start, and ABBA, we can work with that. Then he pointed at some opera vinyl that Severus's mother used to listen to when he was little, and again, for the most part, Harry was too young to appreciate, but he liked some of it. At the very last second, Severus remembered himself, or rather the lyrics, and refrained from listening to Boney M.'s Rasputin. It was exactly the kind of song Harry would like, but he was also a very inquisitive boy who was not afraid of asking what he didn't know, and Severus knew that it would be up to him because Lupin would argue that it was his fault. Severus didn't look forward to explaining the socio-political events in Russia at the start of the century, nor the more private affairs of the royal family. Harry discovered that the world was made of songs. Children's songs and folk songs and adult songs and songs with no words in them, but lots of numbers inside that made you want to dance. Harry discovered that sometimes things that you were feeling inside could take form in music and that in turn you could put the music inside of yourself and fly. 6. Harry had never seen the sea. This was something that obviously required fixing. The idea of taking Harry away from his house, where he was safe, terrified both of them, until they realized they were wizards and they could just apparate to the beach for the day and then go back. Harry would sleep in his warded home where nothing could get him, and there were still dark people looking for him, just as the supposedly good people did. They went to Plymouth. Severus made the jump because he remembered better having been there. They were both anxious, and yet they easily blended with all the other tourists walking around the promenade and the families on the beach. Harry was delighted. He liked the sea, he liked the sand. He liked seeing other people and running away from the waves and drawing in the sand. They had quite literally to drag him back home, each grabbing a flailing arm while he begged for 5 more minutes and swore he was not hungry, they could go ahead and have dinner without him, he would just be here playing. They went back every day for a week, and Snape was sunburned.
I saw your last article. It was good.
Oh, thanks. The editor thought it was appropriate for the season, river and sea creatures.
Very informative. A bit too short, perhaps, but I understand the limitations of the paper.
Yes, I couldn't really expound on each type, so I had to content myself with explaining how to best recognize them and know which ones are dangerous. A pity that it didn't come earlier. Mr. Hewitt would have benefited from reading it.
Mr. Hewitt? Do you mean Professor Hewitt?
Didn't I tell you? He won't be a professor next year, that's for sure.
Remus stopped in his tracks. Snape was sporting a satisfied expression that was very alarming. His voice had more velvet and lemon than usual, which meant there was something big he wasn't saying.
Snape.
What?
An encounter with Grindylows, I'm afraid.
Grindylows? Those are... He is missing quite a few chunks of his legs and sides, I'm told.
Grindylows live in water,
piped Harry, who had been only half-listening while he decorated his sandcastle with shells.
If they catch you, you have to keep calm and hit them above the wrist, and they will release you.
Harry didn't know magical defenses quite yet, because he hadn't turned 6, not for a couple of weeks yet, and his magic was erratic. But Remus would be damned if he didn't teach him everything else to protect himself. Besides, a wand could be dropped. This method worked always.
half eaten by Grindylow's Circe's curls.
"Why don't you use your names?"
asked Terry in between bites of his ice cream. "What do you mean?" answered Remus, peering down. They were enjoying quite a nice walk through the streets of Plymouth.
"Of course we use our names. He don't call him Severus."
"Ah, well, how to explain?
Sometimes grown-ups don't use each other's names unless they are very, very, very good friends. They use their surnames instead," said Remus.
He thought it was an excellent answer. "Better than, we didn't like each other that much, and we only learned to tolerate each other's presences because of you, because we both want you to be all right." He had become quite adept at this child-rearing thing.
"Mr. Bertrand calls you Remus,"
Harry said loud and clear, exhibiting the typical unfortunate commentary children are so prone to.
"Oh, does he now?" Snape said in that sarcastic monotone that could be so damn funny when directed at someone else. "And are you very, very, very good friends with Mr. Bertrand, Mr. Lupin?"
"He's the music teacher,"
informed Harry quickly. How could he talk so much when he had such a big ice cream?
"No, I am not very good friends with Mr. Bertrand," answered Remus,
and because he had to show Snape he could dish them as well, he added,
"I believe he wants to be my friend more than I want to be his, my dear Severus." "Evius, Mum, says Mr. Bertrand thinks he is somewhere called a Yeniston book."
"Harry, don't talk so much. Your ice cream is going to melt." It had all started quite as a joke and as a silent fight, but they were both using each other's names now. And they were friends. He guessed that's what they were. Friends who verbally sparred over wine and who never fought when discussing Harry's well-being. Friends who quietly exchanged Christmas gifts, but not during birthdays. The most unlikely of friends, but friends nonetheless. Severus had thought there was something strange about the new DADA teacher. He got a weird impression of him. For example, he was quite sure that on Monday he was wearing a female brassiere under his clothes. Severus didn't see it, but the way the robe creased on his back was quite distinctive. Given that Chadwick was a tall, broad man with the typical boxer's broken nose, the brassiere was clearly an unnecessary wardrobe choice, as he lacked the breast development that usually required additional support. Severus, of course, didn't mention it and didn't judge, to each their own. If he enjoyed wearing female lingerie, that was no smell off Severus's cauldron. He had seen weirder things. He wished he could say he had witnessed them at the establishments Lucius favored, and Severus still visited every few months to protect his private life, but the truth was most of it came from the Slytherin dorms and from his Death Eater days, which many would say were one and the same. Still, it was just a feeling. He barely saw the professor otherwise. He was usually absent from the meals, and he had only come twice to the professor's common room. He was not the only one who thought there was something about him, though. It was Filch, however, who was the one to raise the alarms about Chadwick when, for the third time in as many days, he caught students playing outside in the garden when they were supposed to be in their DADA class. Cross-examination of said students revealed that Chadwick was only very occasionally going to class, and never with the sixth years, who were studying the subject on their own. The heads of house, plus Dumbledore, met with Chadwick, who after barely 5 minutes of interview broke down and started to cry, saying that it was all a joke that went out of hand and that she was oh so very tired and very, very sorry.
"A Nymphadora Tonks," Severus said. "She is, of course, Andromeda Black's daughter and, most importantly in this case, a Metamorphmagus."
Remus buried his face in his folded arms. His shoulders shook with laughter. He could not form any words for the next minute. He emitted something close to a whine, though.
"My dear, how would you not notice, Severus, one of your students?"
"She is not in Slytherin," Severus informed him with a perfectly calm voice.
"What?"
"I resent your prejudice. That kind of troublemaking is more in keeping with your house."
"Yes, but I can't believe Minerva wouldn't notice it. You have plenty of other things to think about."
Remus smiled. Mr. Bertrand, the music teacher, had a lot of thoughts about that smile. Severus nodded in acceptance of the hidden apology in Remus's words, and, unlike the music teacher, did not dwell on the smile at all.
"In any case, Miss Tonks is a third-year Hufflepuff." This time even Severus had to chuckle. Thing is, they didn't know what had happened to the real Chadwick. Tonks said she had seen him on the Hogwarts Express. That's where she got the image to copy, but then he didn't come to class on Tuesday, and her group of friends thought it would be so funny if she went and taught the Slytherin-Gryffindor third-year DADA class. They found an emergency replacement, so that at least the fifth and seventh years had someone to help prepare them for the exams.
Young Lycum had graduated from Hogwarts the previous year, and everybody still saw her as the Ravenclaw-haired girl, but she had exceeds expectations on her newts. The highest qualifications of the last 3 years, outstanding grades and DADA newts, were rare, and she was available. So they made do with her, even if she still called her new colleagues professor and trembled in fear of Filch. Sometimes, usually when they were around the school, Harry referred to Remus as Dad. He knew he wasn't his real dad. Sometimes he also called him Uncle or Remus, but with school, it was just easier to call him Dad rather than man who is acting like my dad because my mum and dad died in an accident and my other aunt is very, very bad. It was just a mouthful, especially when you were arguing with the other kids over whose dad was better. He had suffered a lot of anguish for a while at the thought of being adopted and at his parents' deaths. There was something very much like the smell of sweat and tangled sheets over your face in the knowledge that his parents were dead, that he had been all alone once. It was a fear and sorrow that took over everything, like a room with a slanted ceiling. Remus noticed somehow. Even if Harry didn't say a word, Remus knew, and he sat Harry on his lap and told him that he loved him the most out of the whole world, that he loved him now and he would love him tomorrow and the day after that, always. That he loved him even if Harry ever did something bad. Harry would be loved forever, and as long as Remus lived, Harry would not be alone in the world. That and a chocolate wand after dinner was all Harry required to put existential anguish out of his heart. It is a great thing to know you were loved. 7. By the time Harry was 7, Remus thought they may have rescued well over half a dozen birds, all nursed back to health by Harry. They even had a dedicated shoebox now for the injured birds. This was the age when most wizards and witches started to show some magical ability. In Harry's case, it was the age when he finally started to show some restraint. Magic was now limited to first days of snow, very sunny days, days when Severus accepted baking something with him, days when there were fireworks and every time there was a particular piece of music on the radio. And it was a vast improvement over the age of 4, when Harry mimicked everything he saw on the TV and made the silverware dance. Remus was making a bit of money now, thanks to his articles for Magical Review. He wasn't wanting for anything, but he also very rarely spent on himself. He had grown used to being careful with what little money he earned, and when he started this, only got what was best for Harry, but it was different, using Severus's money on himself, especially when he was already getting the Wolfsbane for free. Now Remus could buy himself a wool sweater if he wanted, or a bottle of wine once in a while, rather than letting Severus always be the one to bring it. And on Christmas, he could get them decent gifts. A set of books for Harry and a pair of silk black gloves for Severus. Thin enough that he could still use his wand or stir a cauldron, but a welcome layer for the humid chill of the dungeons. It was the most bizarre affair. Brennan, DADA teacher after Miss Lycum, came while recommended. He had defeated that hag in the northern countries and studied snow and ice creatures in depth. Rumors said he could speak with wolves, though Severus doubted it, and Remus failed to see what a wolf would have to say to the man. He was tall and broad-shouldered, blue eyes just like the ice he knew so well, and a shock of red hair despite no known Weasley connection. Now this man was lying at the bottom of the Gryffindor Tower. Given Madame Pomfrey's expression, he wasn't in any condition to explain how he had come to be there, but evidence suggested he had somehow entered the Gryffindor rooms, for which he had no clearance, and once there located a window from which to jump to his current position on the ground. It made absolutely no sense. The castle wasn't short on windows or heights precisely that he would have to resort to breaking into the rooms of one of the houses. Besides, no one could see why Brennan would want to jump anyway. He was popular and attractive. Witch Weekly had featured him in the month of December and again in February in the 12 Wizards to Fall For section. The magazine argued that Brennan's beard was reason enough to include him. McGonagall was interrogating the students, of course, but so far she hadn't learned anything. Most of them were gone to Hogsmeade or preparing for exams, so it wasn't impossible that no one had heard or seen him. Severus sighed tiredly. Brennan had seemed like a nice fellow, but there had been something in his eyes Severus didn't like. He wouldn't say it was coldness just because they were ice blue and he knew so much about winter creatures, but they were calculating even when his smile was so warm. Also, his stupid beard was stupid and Severus had seen better. He volunteered to wait with the students gathering outside while McGonagall interrogated the prefects in her office one by one. Severus had come to accept his powers, strange and undesired as they were. He only had to stand by the window at the end of the corridor short of 10 minutes before a teenage girl sidled up to him Severus said nothing. Others would have greeted the girl and possibly offered her candy, but Severus had learned that it was best to let them gather their thoughts and courage in peace. Although this one was taking more time than usual. Severus was starting to get bored by the view. Besides, there was a draft by the window. The next time a professor came by, Severus made sure to make a disparaging and utterly inappropriate comment about Brennan. Flitwick looked taken aback, and Quirrell stuttered so much he stopped talking altogether and had to be guided gently away by Flitwick. But as soon as they turned the corner, Severus found he now had two students next to him, and it didn't take them long before they started to speak. It definitely was the most bizarre affair. The matter wasn't helped by the ridiculous Gryffindor solidarity and their refusal to speak. That in itself should have told the faculty all they needed to know. If the students were protecting one of their own, they must think he or she was in the right. It took Severus a while, and half a dozen hushed conversations in the corridors and the stairs. He still didn't know what exactly had happened to Brennan, but he knew why. And honestly, he didn't care if the entire Gryffindor fifth year had decided to beat Brennan to death with Quidditch bats and later thrown him over the window to hide the evidence. Unlikely, unless they had a friend in Slytherin, which Severus knew they did not. Besides, a Slytherin would have told them to do it from another tower. What Severus knew, and this is what he explained in the emergency meeting at the headmaster's office later that night, was that Brennan had been circling the Gryffindors for a while now, and that he may or may not be related to young Elderberry, fifth-year strawberry blonde, hilariously big front teeth that gave him a lisp, who would be inheriting quite a considerable sum of money upon reaching the majority age. However, if some regrettable accident were to befall poor Elderberry, the fortune would pass to his maternal cousin, Marcus Cesario Brennan. Had Brennan accessed the Gryffindor Tower with a nefarious purpose? It was hard to say, since Elderberry hadn't been there at the time. He had spent the day in Hogsmeade, and, funny thing, there were at least three students from different houses that could attest to having seen him at all times. It was agreed that Brennan had gained unlawful access to the Gryffindor Tower, and that the spirit of Godric Gryffindor himself had risen up in the defense of his students. And if someone else noticed the dark hairs in Brennan's robes, or the red marks on the neck of one of the sixth-year students, no one mentioned it. Certainly Severus didn't. The Brennan affair unfortunately opened once again the case of the missing Harry Potter. Not in the papers or in public opinion, thankfully. The public never even learned that Harry was missing, but between the old members of the Order, that still kept some contact. There was nothing to say, really. They hadn't discovered anything new other than the occasional plot and the usual rumors, but Severus felt a bit more disappointed and disenchanted than usual when he heard the same old repetition of, Harry must be with his relatives. Look at Elderberry's relatives. Look at Harry's. Harry could make ladybugs walk around all the fingers of his hand before flying away. He could get butterflies to perch on the back of his hand. Birds didn't fly away from him, and they let themselves be petted, which Harry loved because their feathers were very soft. Harry would very much like to have a dog, but Remus said no and that it was enough that he had a wolf once a month. He asked Severus, too, just in case, but he had said the same thing. Harry contented himself with petting every dog he came across and every cat. He also talked to Mrs. K. Mrs. K lived in the creek near the school grounds. She had a yellow ring right behind her head and the rest of her body was dark green. Mostly she talked about the frogs she'd eaten and about keeping away from the birds that would try to eat her instead. It wasn't much in the way of conversation, but Harry liked talking to her either way. There was a field trip with the school, and Harry saw a horse, a cow, and a pig. He petted all of them. 8. When Harry turned 8, he received a Walkman and 3 cassette tapes. Every single object in the house jumped one inch in the air and stayed there for an hour, so happy was Harry. And for the rest of the week, the spoons vibrated gently every time Harry listened to his music. That summer, Harry learned how to ride a bike, and Severus and Remus found themselves taking increasingly longer walks around the country trails so Harry could practice. Remus now associated Severus with the smell of grass and daisies under the summer sun. Severus spent the summer in Spinner's End, officially, but more often than not he stayed over at the cottage. Plenty of his things were there from his weekend visits during the school term, and it was as simple as Cask and Gorgio on the couch so he could spend the night. Severus made breakfast and taught Harry about food and music. Remus prepared lunch and gave Harry the very best books to read. Remus had a weirdly specific mental image of Teresa. She was the housewife who greeted everyone warmly and offered them tea and then excused herself a second to go check the cake she had in the oven, and when she returned she had a sawn-off shotgun and she killed the mobsters that had come looking for her brother, husband, son. He couldn't tell exactly why, particularly when she herself admitted to not being a good baker. Teresa had two children, Eddie, who was a kid of 13 or 14, and Olivia, who was a year older than Harry, but since there weren't that many kids in the school, they had become close friends. Teresa was divorced and worked at the reception desk of a nursing home two towns over, where the high school was. Remus had a good relationship with her. All the other divorced mothers and the widow had flirted with him one way or another when he first started taking Harry to school. They were all lovely ladies, and they meant well, but the attention was awkward nevertheless. Teresa had divorced just recently, and had no interest in men. She had made no passes at Remus, and so she was the first to befriend him. When she had the evening shift, her eldest, Eddie, picked up Olivia from school. But 2 days a week he had drama practice, and so Remus picked up Olivia and Harry and helped them with their homework.
"It's not due until Friday!"
"I don't care, you do it now." Until Eddie came over to pick up his sister. Eddie was quite possibly one of the most awkward teenagers in the British Isles. He was shy, unathletic, sensitive, and obviously upset about his parents' divorce. He also sported a very unfortunate haircut. Harry adored him and thought he was the epitome of all things cool. Not that the opinion of an 8-year-old matters much to a teenager, but still, Harry loved him. He loved that he had Asterix and Tintin books, that he and Olivia read together sitting on the floor, their backs on the couch, that he would talk to Harry about animals, and that he knew Star Wars, and would have the final word on the debates on whether or not there were girl Jedis, yes, and what people ate on Tatooine, potatoes. They grow them on the sand. Harry was attracted to kindness, and he had a way to make you a better person just for fear of disappointing him. Why, Severus willingly ate ice creams now, because Harry couldn't conceive that a person wouldn't like ice cream. Remus almost made a point of talking to Eddie and praising him for his interests. He could tell that although Eddie acted as if it didn't matter and he didn't care, it meant something to the boy that an adult would think his love of stars and animals had value.
"Harry's showing,"
said Teresa one day, as the kids were playing in the square. It was a bit too cold to just stand out there, but the running kids were perfectly fine. They were sweating while Remus felt the cold seeping in through the sole of his shoes.
"Showing?
His magic," Teresa said as if it were perfectly normal, and they were not in the muggliest of muggled villages.
"I am sorry." "You do know, don't you? You look like a wizard to me. You have a wizard name."
Remus was aware that his mouth was hanging open as he looked at the woman. She wasn't looking at him. Her eyes were trained on the kids, who were currently conquering the castle that used to be a stone bench.
I really don't know what to say." "You don't have to say anything."
Teresa was quite possibly the greatest muggle Remus had met.
"Yesterday the kids were playing," she went on, "and Harry levitated a stone. I don't think he intended to do it. They were playing Jedis, and he looked quite surprised. But you should know."
"Thanks, I'll have a word with him." To further prove that Teresa was a queen, she switched the topic to the school raffle next month and how she was not looking forward to baking a carrot cake and having to bid on other people's crap. It turned out that Teresa had been married to a wizard. She had a clause 73 exception and everything, which Remus didn't even know existed, that registered her as a knowledgeable muggle, putting her in the same category as squibs. Mostly it meant people could do magic in front of her without breaking any laws and without her having to be obliviated. Not that she cared. She was not impressed with the wizarding world, and no amount of charms would change her mind. The reason for this was Eddie. Sweet, awkward Eddie, who had turned 11 and had not received a letter from Hogwarts. He didn't have to, it was all right, and he was a great boy.
"He really is," Remus agreed.
Any boy willing to design and draw a coat of arms on a t-shirt for his sister to wear when she was playing knights had to be good. But Teresa's husbands disagreed. They had spent 3 months fighting, 3 more living separately and trying to fix things, and before the year had ended, they had divorced.
"I suppose it was all right for the wife to be a muggle, isn't it? Just a hot piece to keep it on waiting for him," Teresa said.
In her voice, there was smoke and gunpowder and the deceiving smell of something sweet in the oven.
"But not the boy. The boy had to be a wizard and carry his legacy out in the world."
Remus didn't understand. Harry could be a 6-legged squib with red eyes, and he would still love him with all his heart. So yeah, Teresa was not impressed with the wizarding world, especially because she hadn't failed to notice that once it became clear that Eddie wasn't remotely magical, the ex hadn't wanted to wait around to see how Olivia turned out. It was the boy or nothing, and it would be nothing for that man, whereas Teresa loved her children with all her soul. Oddly enough, Severus barely spoke of this year's DADA teacher. He only said that she was competent, which was wonderful praise considering the latest professors. She was a bit more than that. Kayla Miller was good at charms and countercurses. She had an award-winning smile, big breasts, and the open and confident personality of Americans. She was perhaps a bit too informal for the hallowed halls of Hogwarts, but she was very well liked nevertheless. She played sports, she laughed loudly. She was always there for any female student in need of advice. She certainly didn't plan to murder anyone. She also made her interest in Severus known quite clearly, not seeing the point of the British ceremony and shyness. And Severus said no, not knowing exactly his reasons why, other than the fact that she was so wrong, while he could recognize her multiple virtues. She was kind, she was smart, she was very strong. She got the cutest freckles on her cheeks with the sun. Yet she was lacking something. Severus didn't know what, other than that she wasn't it. She left at the end of the course to the student's disappointment. She had gotten a better offer at a private academy, and as she said, glancing aside, no one gave her a good reason to stay. Her words were devoid of anger, pure and white acceptance that it was not to be. That's how good she was. Severus wished her all the best. Just in case, Severus increased his visits to the sad brothel. Exquisite Lounge for the Discerning Gentleman was the name on the card, but to Severus it was a sad place that only the very arrogant, like Lucius, or the very cruel, Mulciber Sr., though strangers before they went to prison, Dolohov, could enjoy. He hated the place, but he needed it now to justify why he would pass over such a pretty, funny woman like Miller. He had to present himself as socially inept, already there, and a pervert. Hell no, not at all, maybe a bit during his Hogwarts years, but funnily he had had the tamest thoughts since Harry. Make himself look like he didn't know and didn't want to know how to talk to people. Like he couldn't appreciate Miller or was too scared of rejection when she got to know him better. The lounge prided itself on its discretion, and it had to be if a Malfoy gave it their patronage. So Severus didn't even have to bother going for the full service to keep his cover. To be seen entering or leaving the place was enough. So he could just lay down in one of the multiple rooms, drink the overpriced alcohol, and wait an appropriate amount of time. It was, unfortunately, an excellent time to ask himself why in Helga's hell he hadn't fallen for Miller. She had all the good traits that had attracted him to Lily, while being different enough that she wouldn't be just a substitute. Also, she had been interested. Someone had actually thought Severus was deserving of attention and desire, if not love. Also, she had no other intentions, as far as Severus could tell. That was a first. So why the hell not? What exactly did she not have that Severus wanted? No, actually, let's not answer that, never mind. It was a stupid question that Severus should not have asked. What he should ask is whether there was a way to reverse amortentia and make you stop feeling in a certain way about someone. Remus took Harry to the local doctor on schedule and got him all his shots and all his checkups and always left the consult with a fuzzy feeling at the notion of Harry being healthy. This year they discovered he needed glasses, which was expected. Remus bought him a pair with green frames. The pediatrician was also a bit concerned that Harry exhibited some signs of hyperactivity and attention deficit, but not enough to get a diagnosis. Harry could pay attention. He did, in fact, to an outstanding level, and he had a wonderful memory. He could not, however, remain still for a long time, which didn't necessarily interfere with what he was doing. Remus wouldn't trust Harry with a pair of scissors, but otherwise he could read, draw, cook, and brew, watch a movie, and play a game. Only there would always be some part of his body moving at the time. And that was good, because if Harry was moving his leg, then he wasn't moving the chairs around him. This year Harry learned what it was to love, truly love, people beyond the house. He also learned to control his magic better and to take deep breaths when he was agitated. The wallpaper in his bedroom now changed color because Harry wanted it, most of the time, rather than because he was feeling something. Also, he had been given the marvelous gift of glow-in-the-dark stickers shaped like stars, which Harry would say was the relevant thing here if one were to ask Harry what he thought about his year. The stickers were awesome. He put them on the ceiling over his bed, and he stared at them every night before going to sleep. 9. Lyle Lupin passed away on a Wednesday. It shouldn't have been a surprise. He was old, and he had been sick for a long time. Yet Remus felt like he had been robbed of something once again. Teresa offered her condolences and said that of course Harry could stay with them for a couple of days while Remus went to the funeral. Harry had been extremely sad at the idea of Remus's father dying, obviously extrapolating from his own fears of being orphaned once again. but he was also quite excited at spending more time with Olivia and the kids had already planned every hour of the day. Lyle Lupin had been well known and respected. There were quite a lot of people from the Ministry in attendance and a few from the Order. Remus shook hands with all of them and hollowly thanked them for coming, faces and names blending one after the other. It was better this way. Otherwise he might start noticing the pitying glances, the sorries charged with meaning, the question nobody dared asking of what he was going to do now. The poor young werewolf, lost in the world without his father's help. And those were the ones who knew about his lycanthropy. The others weren't even sorry for him. Thought it was about time he let go of the losses of the war and got himself a proper job. There were less people in the cemetery and less still on his way back to his father's house, but Dumbledore was there. Dumbledore with his golden half-moon glasses and those twinkly blue eyes Remus used to love, and had then learned to distrust, breaking his heart. He used to revere those eyes and that kind voice, like you do with a benevolent god. Dumbledore had given him the chance to study at Hogwarts to make friends, had given him what no other wizard would, and he had gained Remus's love and loyalty. It hurt. It hurt then, and it still hurt now, Remus having to lie to Dumbledore's face. Somehow it hurt even worse than not having been able to show Harry to his father, tell him that in a way he was his grandson. It hurt because Dumbledore had been so good to him, so generous. How could he be the same person that allowed for a ring of bruises to form on a child's arm? How could he forgive that and want to send Harry back? How could he be so wrong? How are you, Remus?
I'm as good as can be expected, Professor.
Of course, of course. It is such a pity. Dumbledore still sounded kind, honestly interested. And who have you been all this time? I haven't heard much of you all these years. Was there something calculating in his gaze? A sudden realization, perhaps, Remus couldn't say.
People are not quick to hire my kind, offered Remus. But he felt out of practice. Too many chats with parents outside the school. Too many conversations with Severus and Teresa. He had forgotten how to sound resigned to his bleak fate. He couldn't sound happy. People find it hard to forgive your happiness. They will be sorry for you, but they won't be happy when you refuse to be miserable, as is expected and proper.
I'm doing some small work in research, Remus added. And thank Merlin and Morgana for Severus providing such a good explanation. Bless his rotten, paranoid core.
It's not much, but enough to go by.
Ah, excellent, excellent. You have always been one not to run away from a challenge, even if life has given you harder and longer tests than most. Don't you know it well? Remus smiled, made himself remember how he had felt at his graduation from Hogwarts and the words Dumbledore had dedicated to him in a private chat. Family. Belonging. They had been so sweet. Let that sweetness and gratefulness show in his eyes.
Thank you, Professor. Just thank you.
Remus felt Dumbledore's eyes on him all the way from the graveyard to his father's cottage. His black robes were a bit used on the neck and the cuffs. It should be all right. They should look old and poor enough.
I am sorry I couldn't be there.
It was raining heavily, and Severus's hair and shoulders were still wet. Harry was occupied on the big table in the living room, making a treasure map to play with during recess. Remus was just getting started preparing lunch. Severus's words. They felt like the first honest condolences Remus had heard since Teresa's. Not that the people at the funeral hadn't been sorry, but there was the underlying question of whatever would Remus do now without his father's support. Remus hated it. He wished he could blame his wolfish nature, claim he was untamed and free at the core. But the wolf actually liked company. It was the man who hated feeling dependent on his father, on Severus.
That's quite all right, he said. Your presence would have risen too many questions, but thanks.
Severus nodded and went to take his long black robe and change into one of his band shirts. Mr. Bertrand had spotted him once and assumed he was a priest, but Teresa, who could be quite wicked at times, had informed him that Severus was a relative of Harry from another family branch that worked in fashion design, hence the clothes.
Your heart seems heavy.
Severus had returned to the kitchen. He bent down to look for one of the pots and the big bowls.
starting the fire. Whether he was going to prepare a sauce or one of his potions, Remus didn't know. More like turmoil. I imagine you don't want to talk about it. No, Severus, Remus snapped. I do not want to talk. Damn the Slytherins, and Severus in particular. It was flan he had made, filling the house with the smell of caramel and warm milk and orange. Remus was very sensitive and attuned to smells. He couldn't help it. That particular combination, the hot milk with the orange peels inside, just made him relax. It was comforting. Severus had recently brought a stereo to the house. Neither that nor the TV, the VHS player, the radio, or the fridge were supposed to work. It was a magical house, after all. Very magical, considering the amount of spells and wards they had put on it. Yet the electronics worked fine. Sometimes they needed a little pushing and bumping, but that was all. There were a few new cassettes for Harry to listen to. Severus suggested trying them after lunch. "I see a bad moon rising," announced a baritone in between cheerful guitar chords. "I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today." Severus looked so damn smug when he made eye contact over Harry's bowing head. It was a wonder how he could keep that straight face, the bastard. There were more songs after that. Harry wasn't particularly impressed because the music was mellower in many of them, but he liked that the name was hidden in something like a hieroglyphic.
"See, because it reads you two, but also you too," he told Remus, all happy and excited.
It was exactly what Remus needed. A voice like rain and the color gray, singing somewhere between melancholy and hope. By the time they had sent Harry to bed, Remus was talking, despite himself, about how bad it felt that everybody thought him incompetent, unable to do anything for himself, about how much he had fought with his father over that, and how he still thought he was right, but it hurt, nevertheless, knowing there had always been that breach between them, and now he was gone, before they could bridge it. About the dark, ugly thought that perhaps Remus was kidding himself, rejecting his father's help only to be depending on Severus's income. About how maybe the world was right, and he couldn't stand for himself. Severus listened in silence, merely humming from time to time to indicate he was paying attention. It still took him a few minutes to talk after Remus was done. Remus breathed deeply. He felt emptied and tired. "The death of a parent is always traumatic. I suppose you're entitled to some morose thoughts and utter nonsense."
Nonsense?
Oh, the things Severus could do with his brows. What a way to indicate how he found your words hopelessly stupid. "Lupin," he said. And it had been years now since they had referred to each other with their surnames. "You are a capable man. You are not the problem." That was very kind, but having emptied his mind from the upheaval that resided there, Remus now felt like nothing could enter back. Not a thought.
"When was the last time Harry cried?" asked Severus.
"Well, he... when he fell from his bike and scraped his legs, but that had been a year and a half ago. Possibly that scene in Dumbo, then, when the mother was chained."
"Exactly," said Severus, not waiting for him to actually answer. "You were doing a good job with Harry," he went on with finality, "and your research and your articles are excellent. You are allowed some sad thoughts, but only until the end of the week."
"It's Saturday night."
"I would hurry up with my wallowing, then."
Remus's work was honestly good. He was unbiased and knowledgeable, and he had a knack for communicating effectively. If he wasn't more popular, it was probably for that approach of his that always went for the cleanest solution. Someone who claimed you didn't need to incendio a net of buzz snaps came dangerously close to saying that there were other ways of doing things beyond what tradition dictated. He actually suggested plenty of those ways, many of which didn't even require magic, for crying out loud, that heretic man. But he was good. Severus had caught Swindells, the current DADA teacher, twice now, taking notes from one of Remus's articles.
"Didn't I tell you?"
And today Severus's voice was like dark chocolate and nuts and a splash of liquor.
"Oh, mercy, that man."
Swindells wasn't that bad, really. They were all reasonably sure that he was not planning on murdering or groping any of the students, although neither had Sauveterre, and he was still the most disliked one. But it was the beginning of March, and he hadn't seriously injured anyone, so that should put him on the tragically short list of good DADA teachers. It's just that he was so damned irritating. Swindells was slow. In movement, too, as it took him for freaking ever to gather his things when he was leaving the faculty room. But mostly, he was slow in mind. One of those persons who, after explaining to them something twice at different speeds, are still utterly confused with step two.
"You patrol the corridors,"
McGonagall said in much the same tone she used with the fourth-year student who still couldn't reliably manage simple needle match switches.
"Yes, but when?"
"For Merlin's sake, man. You look at the schedule, and if you see your name, you go patrol the corridors to see if there are any students out of bed."
And so, of course, Swindells missed his next class and went on patrol instead and gave attention to the entirety of the fifth year that was making its way to the herbology class.
"I'm so sorry, Minerva. I saw my name in the paper and I thought..."
Minerva didn't want to know what he thought. He always arrived late to the meetings. He forgot which Saturdays he was supposed to stay at Hogwarts while the others went to Hogsmeade. He got lost constantly, and Severus had to give detention to some second-year Slytherins when he learned they were giving him the wrong directions deliberately. At least the Slytherin prefects were more subtle about it. The classes weren't so bad, since mostly they just read from the book and he gave them supplemental materials, like copies of Remus's articles, among other authors. So he wasn't completely incompetent in that aspect, but for the fact that he never gave the right copies, not even once. The students were quite adept at figuring out which year needed the article on vampires and who was supposed to study curses and hexes. There was a free exchange market Fridays during lunch hour where people switched notes. Then there was the day he decided to take his students to the Forbidden Forest for a practical test, which was, yes, forbidden. And the time Hagrid had to explain there really was a giant squid in the lake, and he should not bathe there no matter how sunny it suddenly was. Of course, he didn't listen, and he ended up with a Grindylow bite for his trouble. And there was only one Whomping Willow at Hogwarts, and it did not change its location. They had already explained. If he walked into a tree, that was a different matter. And Severus was not a trained healer. He was a potions master. He brewed potions. If Swindells was feeling unwell, he should go ask Madame Pomfrey. And no, Severus couldn't take a look anyway, and he would not make him a remedy. And those were not his chocolate-covered berries. And they had not been left there for everyone to take some. This was the third time it happened. It took some special talents to irritate Flitwick. And he held a 20-minute conversation with Mrs. Norris, thinking it was McGonagall. And Madame Hooch was a woman, and she would appreciate it if he would refer to her as such. And Professor Binns and the Bloody Baron were two different ghosts. And Madame Pince was human. And she did not understand where he got the notion that she was some flesh monster with three mouths. Neither was she an accomplished baker, nor was she wanting to show him her culinary skills. Given that Severus had become the resident jerk, a deliberate choice to avoid nosy questions and entertaining the notion that he could be nice to, let alone allied with, anyone, it fell upon him to set Swindells straight. The others would send him murderous glares, but they would not speak. Madame Hooch may very well beat him with a Quidditch bat. Severus was tempted to wait just to see that. In the end, the decision was made for him when the sixth-year female prefect pointed out to him that Swindells kept mispronouncing Harira Prorus and Suruchi Subadar's names. Which, okay, the first few times they understood, but it just went on despite correcting him every time, and Suruchi, second year and already planning her career in the ministry, called him out on it the next time he called roll.
"Yes, well, the funny foreign names sound all the same. You know I'm calling you, don't you, Mr. Prater?"
"Subadar."
"And no, I do not."
"Let's just change your name for something more adequate," he went on in what he thought was a reasonable tone.
"How about Smithers?"
The prefect had found Suruchi in the bathroom, washing her hot tears of rage. Swindells had doctored 10 points for insolence and disruptive behavior because she kept fighting it rather than dropping the topic and letting him continue with the class. The girl had been quite unreasonable, is what he said. Severus came to the professor's common room looking very much like the personification of an avenging spirit. Some of the first-year students who saw him go swore he didn't have feet and was in fact floating in a cloud of ash and smoke. There was a sulphurous smell in the air around him. The sound of the door closing behind him was like the executioner's axe.
Filch only told the students lingering in the corner to get lost twice, and he didn't insist after that. Swindells had a knack for filling the freshly cleaned corners with mud, and Filch relished what little pleasures he could get. Everybody agreed. It was most satisfying, scary, but satisfying. Quirrell peed himself a little bit. Swindells complained to Dumbledore, of course he did, which was like threatening the Gale with taking it to court, for all the good it did. And the next day, Flitwick presented Severus with a whole bag of chocolate-covered berries. He gave the berries to Remus. He was the one with the sweet tooth, after all. Plus, it allowed him to tell the story of how he had gotten them, and Remus looked indignant at first, and then ridiculously proud and happy, and made him describe the reaction of every single person in the room. It was that same night, the night at the end of spring full of wind and rain, the night when they helped Harry with a school project, and they had dinner and saw a movie, and then Harry went to bed while they stayed up talking in the living room, as they always did, sharing conversation and chocolate-covered berries. They were actually pretty good, sweet and tart. The rain picked up, and there was some thunder and lightning bolts, and between one bolt and the deafening thunder that followed it, the lights of the house blacked out. They fumbled a bit, rising from their chairs and looking for discarded wands to Lumos and for the candles that slept somewhere in a kitchen drawer, and instead, of course, they found each other, bumping in the dark and arms rising and holding so they wouldn't fall, and then not taking the arms back, and then staying like that, standing in each other's space in the dark, shrouded by the sound of the rain outside. And then, closeness. The warmth of skin, breathing in the same air. A kiss.
Dad! What happened to the lights?
Remember, you love Harry with every cell of your being. Was that a smile on Severus's lips?
That was a blackout!
Remus screamed back.
And you should be asleep!
I was reading!
Go to sleep, it's almost midnight!
Severus mumbled that it wasn't even 11:30. The moment was gone. Severus found his wand and got it to Lumos non-verbally, for it'll show off, and Remus got the candles and his own wand. It was late anyway. They didn't need much light, and they should just go to bed, but Remus wanted to make sure the fridge would stay cold until the morning, or whenever the light came back, so they spent at least 20 minutes fixing that. They debated whether to use Glacio, which might be a bit extreme and damage the appliance, or Refrigero, which in turn they thought was too weak. They ended up casting Prefrigifacio, which was seldom used and rarely taught, but Severus thought it was the most adequate since apothecaries employed it for the most delicate ingredients. It should work well enough with the eggs and the milk. Remus had a candle with him, a common, plain candle store-bought. He would now say goodnight and climb up to his bedroom, and Severus would engorge the couch and get whatever he needed from the corner closet that had become his. They would say nothing else, and in the morning everything would be the same. If it had stopped raining, they would go outside for a walk with Harry, and if not, they would stay home and read and cook, and maybe Severus would brew something, and Remus would write down some notes for his latest article, and it would be nice and peaceful, as it always was. It would be safe, known, reliable, customary, and undisturbed. Remus was a Gryffindor. It was up to him to be brave. Severus. Severus turned around to look at him. He hesitated before meeting Remus's eyes. Remus blew the candle out. There was only darkness and the storm. Remus came with little knowledge of amatorial arts. It hadn't been easy to ask when mere tolerance of his presence was already a gift. When friendship had been a feast, he still couldn't believe he got. He didn't dare ask for more when he already had so much. And he understood that friendship was one thing, but loving a werewolf was another thing completely different and too much to ask of anyone. Then there had been the war, and so many more important things to do that he got lost in them. There had been an encounter with Gideon Pruitt, though rushed and born from the excitement of having fooled death once again. Not particularly good, but good enough and sweet afterwards in the shared embrace. Gideon had been killed a week and a half later, and his brother Fabian, too. Afterwards, it was just easier to think only of winning the war. And now he was here. Severus knew what he was doing. There was no doubt about that. And yet there was a certain hesitance about him. No, not hesitance. Second-guessing. He would kiss Remus with ardor, push him against the wall, and put a hand down his trousers, only to suddenly doubt himself,
and take the hand back and spend the next 10 minutes kissing his mouth, his cheek, his neck, with his hands well above his hips and over his clothes. No complaints with that. Kissing was very nice. Kissing Severus was nice, even though he was made of sharp lines and narrow angles. There was this hint of restrained hunger that was most alluring, but Remus would appreciate some sort of clarification on the route ahead, is all. All right, well, that worked, too. Severus walking him to the sofa, turned bed in the middle of the room and pushing him down and demonstrating exactly how you can drive someone mad with just your mouth before even getting properly undressed. That was a good route. Remus remembered to grab his wand and cast Buffliato. That was his last clear thought. After that, there was only the feeling of the darkness and the rain outside, and Remus let himself fall into their warm nest and the quiet, gentle meeting of bodies. And then afterwards, it wasn't so quiet. Thank all the gods for silencing charms, and it was gentle, yes. But there was also some biting on the chest, and Severus scratched him on the back as Remus pushed in. Severus's legs tightly clamped onto his sides, and Remus's hands buried in Severus's hair, which was surprisingly soft and smelled like cranberries. Sunday morning, Severus had a little freak out and acted as if nothing had happened. Remus took his cues from him and did the same, knowing all the while that it wouldn't be long until it happened again. Perhaps he didn't have much experience, but he was not in the habit of lying to himself, and so he didn't take any other lies either. This was not a one-time thing, and it was not mere physical release. Harry noticed, eventually, that Remus and Severus stood a bit closer now, bumped into each other more, but he didn't really think about it. It meant nothing. There were still dinners and country walks, and during the summer, short trips to the beach or the mountains of the north, and a couple of times to the big cities. And lately, Harry had developed an interest in ancient Greece and the Age of Sail and Napoleon, and he was very busy reading about that. But when he was 13, almost 14, Harry looked back to this time and went, "Oh." 10. After only 2 weeks of the term, McGonagall asked Sprout to keep an eye on Miss Tonks in case she had gotten any ideas again. It was not her, however. There was something even more dangerously clumsy than Tonks, and that was Professor Pontifex. She was quite a lovely woman, really, sweet and dedicated to her students and knowledgeable enough. She also tripped on the stairs on her way to class and badly injured her wrist, and she knocked her head with a door on the same day. Then there was the day she went down to the dungeons to ask something of Severus, absent-mindedly leaned on a cauldron that immediately keeled over, and she ended up with burns on her legs and stomach. And then she slipped on the wet floor and went down. Severus still went to the lounge every 5 to 7 weeks, which was the perfect interval of time so that it would look random and natural. The way to spot a cover is when it becomes too regular. He went there and found he hated the place even more. He also came to discover what exactly it was that the lovely Professor Miller lacked. And it was the careful truce that turned into trust with years of work. That and the beard. Remus's short beard was something else. Everybody in the Muggle village mourned whenever he decided to shave during summers. The quaffle, not the bludgers, no, but the one ball that was designed to be visible and expected to be in someone's arms at all times, that is what hit poor Professor Pontifex. If asked, neither of them would say that they were in love, but the thing was, they didn't know. The real tragedy of their generation wasn't so much death as the loss of time. By the time they graduated from Hogwarts, there was an open war and sides to choose, and no time not really to think about it. People did everything big and fast, trying to cram 10 or 15 years in a few months, because there was that shared sense of time running out. Either you did things now or tomorrow you wouldn't have the chance. James and Lily had married at 18, became parents at 20, died at 21. They were not the only ones. The Longbottoms followed the same pattern, only they didn't even have the fortune of death. So for them, love was something passionate and violent. Quick encounters during missions that left the room destroyed afterwards, or marriages when you were still in your teen years. Love for them was those first 3 years of passion. They didn't know. They didn't know about what comes after, the quiet partnership, the easy company.
They didn't know love hides in the exact amount of sugar added to the extra cup of tea. The grocery list, where you thoughtlessly add someone else's tastes beside your own, learning to enjoy new music and books and shows. They had no idea. Severus was able to sneak out of Hogwarts early and got to Harry's school recital on time to witness how the early courses fought their way through something that originally may have been a carol. Then it was time for Harry's year, which was about to perform a modern retelling of A Christmas Carol. Mr. Humbug's mustache kept falling down, and one of the spirits forgot his lines and stood frozen until the end of the play. Harry sang a song all by himself about the importance of generosity and having fun once in a while. He actually had, if not a beautiful voice, a decent sense of rhythm and tone. Everybody thought it was quite nice. In fact, Mr. Bertrand approached Remus to suggest once again that he enroll Harry in after-class music lessons. Such promise he was showing. Remus wasn't doing any such thing, because sometimes Harry enjoyed music a bit too much and made the furniture dance along. There would be no music lessons until they fixed that. Mr. Bertrand had to give his speech, with Severus frowning down at him, and he had to admit it had not come as beautifully earnest as he had practiced it. There was something about this Christmas break, the first, to see the three of them in the cottage for the entire time. Severus cooked the meals and directed Harry on dessert, and there was music and a film and wonderful presents afterwards. And there were perhaps some kisses, hot and intense and fast, but Harry certainly didn't notice any of that. They occurred behind closed doors and a silencing charm. Many things happened, in fact, behind those wards, and every time it felt like something new, every time asking again for permission, it was tentative and sweet. And Severus was astoundingly bossy and also incredibly generous, and Remus wanted to say he would never have guessed. But actually he would have done, because that was just as Severus was every hour of the day.
I'm not, Severus sighed. I'm very tired today.
Severus Snape requiring three attempts to form a sentence. He was certainly tired. Why he was fighting this, Remus did not know.
Come to bed, then, Remus said once more.
Again, Remus would admit that he had no idea of what he was doing half the time, but it was obviously to his advantage, because whatever people knew or thought they knew, it was wrong. He was not faulting Severus's technique, dear Merlin, not at all, but everything else that surrounded the act, clearly Severus had learned it wrong. He took Severus's hand and pulled him after him up the stairs and to the bedroom. Remus pushed him down, and just 10 minutes later they were both under the covers, his arm over Severus's waist. Apparently Severus thought he was only welcome there as long as he could perform, which really, what a ridiculous notion. If he was so tired that he couldn't even accept Remus's enthusiastic attempts at a blowjob, then he certainly needed his sleep, and Remus saw no reason why he should force him into anything or kick him down to the couch. Not that Severus could fall asleep easily despite his exhaustion that day. It was the first time in his life someone had invited him to their bed just for the sake of his presence without any other demands. It wouldn't be the last. Every night, Remus would ask, and he would keep asking, until Severus learned that he was wanted every day. Professor Pontifex willingly resigned from Hogwarts to go back home and rest for a while. She had broken both arms, sprained an ankle, been burned several times, received numerous hits, cuts, and bruises, and in a particularly bizarre accident, almost drowned in a bucket. Remus laughed and laughed and kissed Severus's frown away at the indignity that he had once more been rejected for the DADA position. Dumbledore had chosen trembling, inept, muggle studies Quirrell instead, and Remus sympathized, truly he did. But he also laughed. It was less of an affront if it made Remus laugh. Harry was happy. He was reading well beyond his level, and he was reading everywhere. In school, and at Olivia's, and in the sunny spot on the stairs, and laying on his stomach under the holly tree by the door. He did his schoolwork by Remus's side on the scraped big table of the living room. He read on his bed in that room that had been given to him, his bedroom, with the stained wallpaper whose original color was impossible to know now. Olivia's mom gave him the black tulip for completing primary school, because she knew he had read Dumas and loved it. The adventures, oh, the thrilling adventures. And that he also loved plants. The book was about a flower and about adventure, too. And Harry read it in less than a week. And when he got to a very thrilling bit, all the glass in the house would frost and change color. For his birthday, Severus got him a plant's glossary, a tiny, beautiful edition that compiled over 100 plants and their secret meaning, and all the rules to make a message. It was Harry's first adult book. Not to say he wasn't reading things not deemed appropriate for kids, but it was the first book that didn't have a story in it. Just knowledge and beautiful illustrations. 11. They were scared of what would happen when Harry turned 11. But the day came and went, and there was no letter. They had explained a year earlier. When Harry turned 10, Remus had explained everything. He had even gone for a walk and let Harry talk to Severus in private, in case he had other questions he didn't dare asking him. Harry knew Remus wasn't his real dad, had always known and hadn't cared much. It wasn't that strange. Mowgli was raised by a whole pack of wolves, plus a bear and a panther. Harry just had a dad that once a month turned into a wolf, and a second dad. Kind of like Bagheera, now that he thought about it. He also knew he was a wizard, and that he shouldn't show in public. Now they explained everything else. Put together in a coherent narrative all the bits and pieces Harry had learned through the years. What exactly had happened to his parents. That some bad wizard wanted to hurt him because of a stupid prophecy. But he shouldn't worry, never worry, he was safe. Would always be. And Severus would be the first to know if he came back. That they hadn't exactly asked permission when they took him from his aunt's house. The thing is, Harry remembered. He remembered seeing a man with funny hair in the garden looking in. He remembered talking to him with that easiness with which children sometimes talk to strangers, because why shouldn't they? And certainly a stranger couldn't be worse than what Harry knew at home. He remembered because the man, Severus, had given him an apple, and that was the first thing Harry had eaten in hours that day. He didn't remember, well, what exactly it had been, whether he had sung a song too loudly or he had taken a toy that the other kid said he wanted, but he remembered that he had been punished without dinner that night. He remembered how sweet the apple had been. So really he was quite happy with things as they were, and if going to magic school would make trouble for Remus and Severus, he was perfectly happy going to normal school. He was going to be a vet, or a private detective. He wasn't sure yet. The world kept looking for Harry. Harry, unknowing and unconcerned by this, went on living and learning. Until the world found him. End of chapter 2.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.